But tonight, I'm happy to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Laura Duggan. She is an avid meditator and a champion of the contemplative life. She is author of the book, An Inquiring Life, a book of weekly contemplations. She's a meditation teacher and student of Vedic and Buddhist philosophy and director of the Freestone Retreat Center. Thank you very much for coming tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim. So we're going to be informal, even though I have notes in front of me. Thank you for coming. And let me just start with a poem by Stonehouse. Enlightenment. What kind of thing is it? Drawn in ink, blowing through the pine, the sound of the wind. Enlightenment. What kind of thing is it? Drawn in ink, blowing through the pine, the sound of the wind. Very Zen description of enlightenment. Enlightenment is sort of the overarching theme for tonight in some ways, because 30 years ago this year, I was introduced to my spiritual teacher, my first spiritual teacher, Swami Muktananda, and even the idea of enlightenment, which had never been in my vocabulary, became part of my life. So I feel like 2010 is an anniversary year for me, where I celebrate the idea that enlightenment is possible. Perhaps it's already here. What is it? Why do we want it like that? And I'd like to spend the night kind of looking at some of the insights that have come up along the journey for me. And also, as part of the evening, especially since we're small, there'll be pauses where I'll offer a contemplation where you can see what your life is like in relationship to the same topics. So we'll kind of take this journey together tonight. I wrote a poem early on in my spiritual life. I pass by your window to see if the light is burning, not knowing that the light I seek is everywhere. Pass by the window to see if the light is burning, not knowing that the light I seek is everywhere. When I started out on my spiritual path, it was all about the other outside me, my teacher. Was the teacher awake? Was there a light in the window? Everything was outside. And many people start the path that way, and I don't regret it for a minute. However, one of the things I've noticed is there's a shift that's taken place. And I think I'm beginning to know that the light I seek is everywhere, not just in one person, one window. The other thing that I noticed is when I first started on the spiritual path, it was all about the goal. When will I reach enlightenment? And the Indian tradition has many stories. If you stay with the guru for 12 years, guaranteed you reach it. And some would say, oh no, 3 years with the master is enough. How many years would I need to stay? There's a story of Sheikh Nasruddin. Does everybody know who Nasruddin is? He's a character that's in the Sufi tradition, that's used as the fall guy, I suppose, for the many ways we often think. So he's a humorous character, fictional. One day, Sheikh Nasruddin was out and a traveler came up to him passing by and said to him, can you tell me how long it'll take me to get to Mecca from here? Nasruddin remained silent. The traveler looked perplexed and then repeated his question a little louder. Can you tell me how long it'll take for me to get to Mecca from here? Nasruddin remained silent again. And the traveler repeated his question a third time, and again no response. And so the traveler just shrugged his shoulders and began walking away. And as he got a little bit away, Nasruddin called out, 6 hours. And the traveler turned around and came back to him. I asked you and you didn't answer. Why did you answer now? Master Jean said, I had to see how fast you're walking. So how long will it take to reach enlightenment? How fast are you walking? But I did notice that over the years since I've been practicing, one thing that's happened is I've stopped counting. I literally have. And about 2.5 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I was in an all-day meditation event, actually at the ashram that I used to go to down in Oakland. And we had 7-hour-long periods of meditation with breaks in between. And one of the things I became aware of towards the afternoon sessions was how much ease there was. I wasn't sitting there waiting, when am I going to break through? When is it going to happen? Instead, I was in this complete state of ease, just happy to be sitting and meditating. And that, to me, was an accomplishment. And that's what I mean by sort of moving away from having the goal held so tightly, enlightenment. My teacher, Swami Muktananda, once told a story of two seekers that were sitting under a tree, both doing their practices very seriously, meditating, chanting. And a messenger from Lord Indra came by and saw them. And the seeker said, you're going to Lord Indra, the Lord of the gods. Would you ask him, how long is it going to take us to reach enlightenment? And so the messenger agreed. He went up. And then on his return trip, he came past the tree. And the first seeker said to him, did you find out the answer to my question? How long will it take to reach enlightenment? And the messenger said, yes. He said, for you, it will take 3 lifetimes. The seeker was so disappointed. He just got up and left and said, I'm out of here and done. Well, the other seeker was sitting there. He said, what about me? Did you ask about me? And the messenger said, yes. Lord Indra said, for you, it will take as many lifetimes as there are leaves on this tree. And the seeker was overjoyed. He said, I'll be enlightened. And so he continued his practices. Subtle Zen story. A thought rears up. Years of spiritual practice with nothing to show for it. Unknown, in a new location, no label, no rank, nothing to do or teach, then a voice. It's just a thought. If it's causing pain, drop it. I drop into a new thought. After all these years, how lucky I am to be nobody with beginner's mind. Enlightenment. What kind of thing is it? One of the paradoxes that I have come to really understand as the heart of spiritual practice is the paradox that in many traditions, particularly traditions I studied, such as Indian philosophy and Tibetan Buddhism, you are already the enlightened being and you practice. And that's a paradox to me, and I want to explore a little bit what that looks like and what that means. My teacher, Swami Muktananda, always said the self is already attained, and he had a book called Getting Rid of What You Haven't Got. I'd like to read a small piece of this. The most important question raised in Vedantic philosophy is this. Can you attain what you haven't attained? Or do you attain what you already have? If you're going to get something which you didn't have before, what good is it? Since you didn't have it before and you get it now, there's every possibility you'll lose it sometime. And the question of getting what you already have is ridiculous, isn't it? The truth is, we get rid of what is not, what we don't have, not what we have. In Vedantic philosophy, there is nothing to be done. The only important thing is understanding. Through understanding comes liberation. The self is always present. It has always been there and will always be there. It is wrong to think that you got it just a while ago or will get it after you have done some spiritual practices. Though the self is eternally present within us, it appears as though it were not present because we do not understand it and are not aware of it. We have made a mistake. Once we rectify our mistake, we will experience what we already are. So there's nothing to be attained. Through understanding comes liberation. And I was totally delighted to read, actually, in this current issue of Shambhala magazine, from a completely other tradition, almost the same words from a Tibetan teacher. Swami Muktananda is from the Indian Vedic tradition, and the Tibetan Buddhist tradition has a very similar concept. Tolku Urgyen, who was quite a renowned practitioner, related to his son. Our true nature is already perfect and complete. It doesn't get worse when we suffer or improve when we get enlightened, like the Buddha. We don't need to add anything to it or take anything away. It's here with us each and every moment like a diamond in the palm of one's hand. The problem isn't that we need to get something we don't already have or get rid of the things we don't like. The problem is that we don't recognize what we've had all along. So I love it when different traditions have the same point of view. And I'm going to keep going on this for a few more quotes just to be sure everybody gets the point. This is one of my favorite, most exquisite books. Jim is happy to order it for you if you don't have your own copy. It's very inspiring. It's the life with pictures and quotes of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who was a major figure in Tibetan Buddhism, and today, actually, almost at this moment, if not a few hours ago, his reincarnation is traveling in the United States for the first time and arrived in New York and is giving blessings. So in the Tibet tradition, they consider that when an enlightened master leaves, he comes back again. So it's very fun to think of that. Anyway, he said the same thing. He said the journey to enlightenment is a rediscovery of the forgotten nature, like seeing the ever-brilliant sun again as the clouds that are hiding it blows away. And last week I was at a Tibetan teacher who is teaching out of Richmond, California. He's a wonderful young man, just has wonderful, sweet energy. His name is Anand Thubten. And he gave a beautiful analogy of this. He said, imagine, he was talking about our pure nature being pure awareness. He said, imagine there's a river in front of you, but it's the winter time, and so it's frozen over. There's solid ice. And you go out onto the ice, and you put your ear to the ice. What do you hear? You hear the flowing of the river underneath. He said it's the same with us. The pure awareness is there, but the mind is like that frozen ice and keeps us from experiencing it. I just thought that was such a beautiful analogy. What does Nasruddin have to say about this? Sheikh Nasruddin. One day he was sitting on the side of a river, on the bank of a river, and on the other side of a river, a man saw him and called out, "Oh, Mullah Nasruddin, please tell me, how do I get to the other side?" Nasruddin looked at him quizzically and called across to the river, "You're already on the other side." The Yoga Vasishta is another wonderful work. It's a dialogue between sage Vasishta and Brahma, who is it's before Rama became Rama who conquered all the demons. He's just a prince at this moment, but he's a very dejected prince, and I'll read a passage in a minute. But one of my favorite lines in the book is when Vasishtha is talking to Rama and says, "Oh Rama, you are already a liberated being. Live like one. You're already a liberated being. Live like one." So I'd like to pause for a short contemplation right now. You can just close your eyes for a minute and tune into your heart and inquire for yourself, what would it look like for you to live as if you were already a liberated being? What would it look like for you to live with the conviction that you are already liberated? Interesting sound. Oh, it's been in my hand.
Would you like a different one?
That's fine. Lost track of myself. It's pure and bright and totally present. You ask me what it's like? Among you Buddha-bound wandering monks, how many ever understand? It's pure and bright and totally present. Anybody want to share anything about what it would be like to live as a liberated being? Anything come up? Don't have to share it. Just throw it out. Somebody has something they wanted to say.
There's nothing to say.
Great. I like it.
What came to me was that one would continue to chop wood and carry water, but do it with great joy.
Mm. Mm.
Outwardly, you probably wouldn't change, but inwardly, that would be the change.
Yeah. The traditions go a step further. Not only do many traditions agree that we are already enlightened, we already carry the Buddha nature inside of us, many say even the idea of liberation is a fiction. In the Yoga Vasishtha, the text that I mentioned, it says, "You are already free. Why do you call yourself bound and grieve? The self is infinite. Why, how, and by whom is it bound? There is no division in the self. What then is this thing called bondage and liberation?" And that's not just the Indian tradition, the Heart Sutra, which many Buddhist traditions delight in, says, no ignorance, no end of ignorance, up to no old age and death, no end of old age and death, no suffering, no origin of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path, no wisdom, no attainment, and no non-attainment. And one of the texts of the Vedanta philosophy called the Crest Jewel of Discrimination, which is sitting there under the microphone, had a wonderful quote that I hadn't remembered reading. I love going back to the books that I love and then discovering new things. It says, both bondage and liberation are states of mind, fictions of ignorance. There is neither birth nor death, neither bound nor aspiring soul, neither liberated soul nor seeker after liberation. This is the ultimate and absolute truth. Both bondage and liberation are states of mind. I'd just like to pause for a moment with that interesting concept. Does that ring true for anybody? Have you ever thought of it that way? Both bondage and liberation are states of mind. Something to think about. So there we have one part of the paradox. We're not only already enlightened, but we've got no enlightenment to get, so to speak. On the other side of the paradox, there's a longing for liberation. In the Indian tradition, it's called mumukshutva. And the Buddhists often talk about bodhicitta, that desire to be liberated for the sake of others. And it's very key. I had an interesting experience a few weeks ago. I'm always house hunting. I'm always looking for a smaller place to live with less rent. So I found this sort of suitable place up in Healdsburg, and I discovered it was walking distance from the town, and I went into town and was having dinner at Cafe Gratitude, this little raw food cafe up there. I thought, wow, this town is great. It's got music events, it's got restaurants, it's got shops. It would be so fun to live up here. Look at all of these things I could do. It's really getting into it. And then driving home, like this like visceral thought arose. I don't want distractions. I want to live near some place where there's spiritual practice going on, a monastery or a community or something like that, not restaurants. There's nothing wrong with restaurants, but that's not what I want. And so I rejected the idea of that particular place, but I thought about my motivation and I was feeling a little funny, like, who would understand that? And then the next day happened to be a day that Anand Thubten was speaking, Rinpoche, in Richmond, and I went down to hear him, and he began his talk, and he said, I had a different theme, but I want to talk about what I think is in some people's hearts. And he said, the foundation for spiritual practice is the longing for liberation. And with the longing for liberation, all ordinary desires become secondary. And I felt so validated. I felt very understood, like, yes, that's what we're talking about. It's not that I don't like restaurants, but that longing for liberation is the primary motivation. And he had some beautiful things to say. He said, once you have this desire, liberation is very close. It's not conceptual. You have the desire or you don't have the desire. And then he said, it's called the dawn of enlightenment. With the dawn, there is the certainty that the sun will be there, even if you don't see it yet. In the same way, with the longing for liberation, there is certainty that it will happen. I like that. And in Viveka Chudamani, the Crest Jewel of Discrimination, it's one of the prerequisites for walking the path. He says, longing for liberation is the will to be free from the fetters forged by ignorance through realization of one's own true nature. And even if this longing is present only in a small amount or a moderate amount, it will grow intense through developing virtues, practicing renunciation, and the grace of the teacher. To seek earnestly to know one's real nature, this is said to be devotion. To seek earnestly to know one's real nature, this is said to be devotion. A poem called Lost in Samsara. The morning starts with a dramatic and teary dream. At a train station, I can't remember where I came from, so I can't get home. I wake filled with the symbolism and emotions of the dream, resolving to intensify my practices. But first, a few emails to answer, a few calls to make, all this before meditation. No wonder I can't remember where I came from. No wonder I can't get home. Lost in samsara. And in case you think it has to do with renouncing the world and renouncing activities, I really would like to share the words of Rama, his longing for liberation. The book opens with him being completely dejected and sad and disillusioned. What's the point of this life? What's the point of this palace? And just kind of moping around, neither bound nor liberated. And Vishishta asks him to, you know, explain himself. And he says, after moaning for 20 pages, he says, "Please tell me, what is that condition or state in which one does not experience any grief? How can one who is involved in the world and its activities, as I am, reach the supreme state of peace and bliss? What is that attitude that enables one not to be influenced by various kinds of activities and experiences? Pray tell me, how do you people who are enlightened live in this world? Holy sir, instruct me in that wisdom which will enable my restless mind to be steady. You are enlightened, instruct me so I won't be sunk in grief." And then at the very end he says, "If you consider that I'm not fit or capable of understanding it, I shall fast unto death." That's his longing for liberation. The rest of the book is an answer to his question. Mm. In case you want to know, I'm not going to tell you. To read the book. It can be ordered. It's not out of print. So it's not about longing for liberation, for enlightenment, is not about longing to leave the world, not about longing to be a monk. It's about longing to know how to live in this world with an enlightened attitude. So I'd like to pause one more time and invite you to just close your eyes and ask yourself this question, and you don't have to share it with anybody. What is your longing? What is your greatest desire? Is there a spark in there that really longs for freedom? The Sufis are masters of talking about longing. One of my favorite poems. This is my favorite Rumi poem. All day I think about it, then at night I say it. Where did I come from? And what am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. My soul is from elsewhere, I'm sure of that, and I intend to end up there. This drunkenness began in some other tavern. When I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird from another continent sitting in this aviary. The day is coming when I fly off. But who is it now in my ear who hears my voice? Who says words with my mouth? Who looks out with my eyes? What is the soul? I cannot stop asking. If I could take one sip of an answer, I could break out of this prison for drunks. I didn't come here of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me back. And Hafiz says, I saw you dancing last night on the roof of your house, all alone. I felt your heart longing for the friend. I saw you whirling beneath the soft, bright rose that hung from an invisible stem in the sky. So I began to change into my best clothes in hopes of joining you, even though I live 1,000 miles away. And if you would have spun like an immaculate sphere just 2 more times, then bowed again so sweetly to the east, you would have found God and I standing so near and lifting you into our arms. I saw you dancing last night near the roof of this world. Hafiz feels your soul in mine calling for our beloved. I particularly like this because he says, if you would have whirled just 2 more times, like that seeker who gave up and left because he thought he wasn't getting anywhere fast enough, just hang in there. And that's the paradox that I want to bring us to. We're enlightened, but we long for a state, and we still have to practice. What does that look like? What are we practicing for? Why do we practice? That's what we're going to answer next a few Thursdays, but I'm going to touch on it. Because it is the question, if we're already there, what are we practicing? Well, Sheikh Nasruddin has something to say about this. One day, Sheikh Nasruddin sent his servant out to let him know if the sun had risen yet. The servant came back and said, it was so dark out there, I couldn't see the sun at all. Nasruddin got furious. You fool, why didn't you bring a flashlight? And my teacher commented on that, saying, this is exactly what we do. To expect a spiritual technique to reveal the indwelling God is like expecting a flashlight to illumine the sun. A flashlight cannot shine beside the sun. And like the sun, the self is always shining with its own effulgence. What sadhana, what practice can illumine that self? Only through a subtle and sublime intellect can we know it. We meditate and perform spiritual practices only in order to make the intellect pure enough to reflect the effulgence of the self. We meditate and perform spiritual practices only in order to make the intellect pure enough to reflect the effulgence of the self. It's such a different idea than we're meditating to get enlightened. Because if you hold that we are already there, we can't be meditating to get that. Much to my delight, in this issue of Shambhala, again, I read parallel words that were so beautiful, I just wanted to give you the Buddhist perspective of the same thing that Muktananda, who is an Indian, I don't know what to call him, not Hindu, Vedic, Vedanta, but not Buddhist, gave. So this is a dialogue between Nyingyur Rinpoche, who is a young Tibetan teacher who's traveling in the States. He was in Berkeley just about a month ago. And his father, who has passed away, who was a great teacher. And Nyingyur had just learned to meditate. He said, "One day as we sat together in silence, I glanced up at my father in the middle of my meditation and was surprised to find him gazing down at me. 'Are you meditating, son?' he asked. 'Yes, sir,' I said proudly, filled with joy that he had finally noticed. My answer seemed to amuse him greatly. He paused for a few moments, then gently said, 'Don't meditate.' My pride vanished. For months, I've been doing my best to copy all the other meditators who came to be with my father. I learned prayer, sat in the right posture, tried to still my mind. 'I thought I was supposed to meditate,' I said with a shaky voice. 'Meditation is a lie,' he said. 'When we try to control the mind or hold on to an experience, we don't see the innate perfection of the present moment.' Pointing out through the window, he continued, 'Look out into the blue sky. Pure awareness is like space, boundless and open. It's always there. You don't have to make it up. You don't have to make it up. All you have to do is rest in that.' For a moment, all of my hopes and expectations about meditation dropped away, and I experienced a glimpse of timeless awareness." A few minutes later, he continued, "Once you've recognized awareness, there's nothing to do. You don't have to meditate or try to change your mind in any way. If there's nothing to do," I asked, "does that mean we don't have to practice?" "Although there's nothing to do, you do need to familiarize yourself with this recognition. The reason we still need to practice is that at first we only have an understanding of mind's pure nature. By familiarizing ourselves with the understanding, it transforms into direct experience. Yet even then, we still need to practice because experience is unstable. If we don't continue to familiarize ourselves with pure awareness, we lose sight of it and get caught up in our thoughts and emotions once again. On the other hand, if we are diligent in practice, this experience will transform into a realization that can never be lost. This is the path of the great perfection. This is Dzogchen." So the Tibetans talk about spiritual practice as having three parts. They talk about the ground, or the view that you need to hold, the path, and the fruit. And the ground is the conviction of what our true nature already is, the conviction we are already the self, the conviction that there's nothing to be attained. Our practice begins with that as our understanding. The path is recognizing it. And then the fruit is the experience of our true nature. So in many ways, the ground and the fruit are not different. But one is understanding, and the other is experience. So again, I'd like to pause for a minute and ask for contemplation. Why do you practice? Why do you do spiritual practices? What is the view that you hold as you do them? Anybody like to comment on it? Yeah?
I just remembered something that Humphrey Bogart said to Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen when she asked him about why do you need the engine? I mean, when the engine goes on. And he said, you have to be going faster than the river or else you can't steer.
Great. I like that.
It has to do with partner. It has to do with a partnering with, to speak without the sounds. There's a line that's important to me. To speak without the silence breaking is to join the conversation never ending. It has to do with participating actively in that which you were already totally immersed. That's kind of like the paradox, and it's almost like it's by grace that you are given something or shown a way to be in that the mystery. Mm-hmm. The mystery is a vital mm-hmm. ingredient, almost wondering where do your words come from.
Yes.
Even while you're speaking them.
Thank you. It's very beautiful. I love the idea that you have to go faster than the river, because it makes me think that even though we're already the self, we're also in this river called samsara, you know, and you've got to get a jump start on it. So it's great. Anybody else want to share anything about practice?
Well, it's more of a sort of a practical practice. I mean, when I meditate, I have this goal that perhaps I can just shut down my mind,
mm-hmm.
just shut down the judgment,
mm-hmm.
just shut down
mm-hmm.
the grab.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I sort of make a bargain.
Yeah.
If I do this, could you please?
Yeah. And that's a really interesting point, because one of the things I've been studying recently is the Tibetan Dzogchen and Mahamudra, where the goal is actually to... I'm not a formal student of it. I mean, I'm reading a lot. But what I understand is that the mind can do what it needs to do, and you stand in a different relationship to it. You just see the mind spinning, but you rest in pure awareness. And to me, that's a fascinating idea, rather than trying to, as he said here, you're not trying to still the mind, you're just trying to be present with it. But I think you need to have a qualified teacher working with you, and I find it intriguing. it kind of a different way of practicing. Yeah. But that is, and I think that is one of our goals, is we're dealing with the mind. Yeah. So, what happens? Here's the paradox. We're enlightened. We think we're supposed to know we're the self. We believe it. We have the ground. We're trying to recognize it. Then what happens? Hafiz says, this is not a courtroom anymore. The time of judging who's drunk or sober, who's right or wrong, who's closer to God or farther away, that's all over. This caravan is led instead by a great delight, the simple joy that sits with us now. That is the grace. It may be that you just poured a toast that will wash love clean of all its pictures. This is not a courtroom anymore. I had a dream just a few years ago where I had a dream and an experience of a temple, and the deity was no longer in the temple. And I remember thinking, what do you do with a temple where there's no longer any deity? And I felt it represented my no longer having outer focus for my practice. And then I thought, well, what do I put there? Do I put a new deity? What do you do? And I didn't really have an answer, but as things went along, I recognized that, in fact, not in a self-absorbed way, my own life becomes the deity. The phrase came up, to fall in love with my own life. And I had another experience, because when I first started on the spiritual path, I met my teacher. I also met someone who had been a former Zen monk who was now a monk in the tradition I was in. And I absolutely fell in love with this monk and with his commitment. And that became my model. It just really was a pole star for me. Then I moved to California, left the whole ashram tradition, and I was on a Buddhist retreat, and there leading it was a former Zen monk. And I wrote in my journal, what a difference 25 years makes. Now I'm in love with my own life and my own commitment. And it was like seeing someone who validated now what I was doing, as opposed to seeing someone who I thought was doing something I could never possibly do. So the purpose, they say, of the guru is to give you back to yourself, to discover that we are the one we are looking for. I learned that from my cat, actually. Mm-hmm. A poem called The Cat Curls Up. The cat curls up, snuggling his nose under his tail, as if it were another entity to cuddle with, the zenith of self-love. But it's not about self-absorption. It's more about sensing our own fullness. We make the effort, and then we own our commitment. We see who we are. Hafiz says, now is the time. Now is the time to know that all you do is sacred. Now is the time to understand that all your ideas of right and wrong were just a child's training wheels to be laid aside when you can finally live with veracity and love. Meditation is calling, but it is hard to pull myself indoors when the hawk and 5 wild turkeys have just invited themselves to breakfast in my backyard. Meditation is calling, but it is hard to pull myself indoors when the hawk and 5 wild turkeys have just invited themselves to breakfast in my backyard. Now is the time to know that everything you do is sacred. So for me, the ground is knowing we are that. The path is recognizing it. And then the fruit, the word I put for it is contentment, utter sense of fullness. I want to share an anecdote, 2 anecdotes. The first one is about Ramakrishna, who's a great Indian saint, and he had a main disciple named Vivekananda. Vivekananda came to him once. His father had died and Vivekananda was destitute, no money. He was literally starving. Ramakrishna, his guru, said, go into the temple of the mother and ask for some help, ask her for money. So Vivekananda went into the temple, was there for a few minutes, however long, came back out, and Ramakrishna said, did you ask? And Vivekananda said, no, I forgot. Well, go back again, said Ramakrishna. And Vivekananda said, it's no use, I'll forget again. Why? Your memory's not that bad. Vivekananda said, I'm sure I'll forget again. As soon as I went in there, tears began to fall from my eyes. My meditation began to ripen. I started swaying. In that ecstasy, I was not hungry. I was not poor. I was not needy. I was not poverty-stricken. I was an emperor. The divine began to shower upon me. It seemed so petty to ask for anything, let alone money. When the divine is showering on me, how can I ask for money? I can't do it. Ramakrishna sent him in again. Third time, he came out with nothing again. Ramakrishna said, good, the test is over. Had you asked, you would have betrayed the bond between us as well. I was walking on Duran Beach a few weeks ago on a wonderfully foggy morning. Fog was overhead, and I had my list of prayers to God. I had determined I was going to walk to the end, and I was going to sit down, and this time I was going to really pray. You know, how am I going to find that smaller house, and how am I going to get a balanced budget, and where is the spiritual companionship I want? I made a long list, and I walked. I got to the end, and much to my surprise, the sun was out. Like, I could see the fog was from here all the way there, but where I was and all the way south was clear blue sky and warm sun. It was the warmest I felt all summer. I sat down on the beach. It was just delightful. And I looked at the water and the sparkling ocean and the warmth on my face and sat there for a while. And all of a sudden I remembered, oh, wait, I came here to pray. And at that moment, I could literally not think of anything that was missing from my life. And I finally understood the Ramakrishna story. So contentment is part of, I think, what we get. Walking on the beach, resting on the shore of the ever-in-motion ocean, nothing happening except the imperceptible process of letting go, unclenching the fists of a grasping heart. The Bhagavad Gita, wonderful text, talks about yoga in many terms, and one of the most beautiful lines is this. Let this, the dissolution of union with pain, be known as yoga. Let this, the dissolution of union with pain, be known as yoga. How do I kiss the ocean? How do I embrace the wind? How do I lasso love and put her into words? How do I measure yellow from dawn to daffodil? What scale can I use for weighing the light that is blazing within? Let's take another moment for contemplation. Close your eyes. And picture and feel a time when you were completely content, lacking nothing, desiring nothing. Let yourself feel what it felt in that completeness. summer contentment. Each evening it happens again, at just about the same time, when the sun is setting behind me and the sky is a clear blue palette before me, awaiting its evening rouge. I sit on the back porch as the birds arrive, a hummingbird tonight, yesterday a hawk. The swallows and the smaller birds come out as well. The big raptors are gone for the evening, and the raucous crows have already gone to bed, clearing the air for a tender rendezvous among the gentler creatures. The tiny voices sing in the still evening air, no wind to rustle the trees and drown out their song. My heart sings along. How many lifetimes have I waited? How many lifetimes have I waited for this sweet peace where nothing needs to be done, nothing needs to be said, no one needs to witness the world that is granting me everything my heart could desire, tender love and a full heart, on a warm summer's evening, alone on a porch by the field. So I'd like to end with a short meditation, and I'm going to read a little bit from Where Are You Going to lead us into it, and then you can meditate in any style you want, and we'll sit for about 5 minutes. Is that okay, people? And you can close your eyes while I read and get comfortable. Sit very quietly in your chair. Then turn within and try to see who watches the thoughts from inside. As you keep watching in that way, you will come to know the self. You are looking for what you have never lost. The self is already working inside you. You will find the self when you understand the self. As you keep contemplating the self, as you keep trying to understand the self, it will reveal itself to you. So turn within. Look for that inner knower. God is in your heart. You lost him in your heart. You will find him only in your heart. Slowly open your eyes when you're ready. Thank you so much for coming this evening. May you enjoy the ground, the path, and the fruit of your practices. I think Jim has some announcements.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.